So, the Buddha, when his teachings were brought to the West, they were considered to be pessimistic because the Buddha looked resolutely at not just the fun parts of life, but also at the difficult parts of life. The First Noble Truth the Buddha outlined is that in life, there's going to be old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, grief, despair. There will be separation from what we love, those we love. We'll be united often with people that we don't love that much. And we won't always get what we want. So I thought this week I'd talk about, I'm talking about separation from those we love. It's a really important topic because to open our hearts, to really care for someone, to love someone, means that we are going to experience separation. It could be through death, it could be through life taking people in different directions. To have a child is to experience separation. The child eventually will leave home and go out into the world, often move to different places. To have a parent means that there's a, you know, I mean, more often than not, there's the likelihood that you'll experience their death, their aging, their sickness, their death. To have a human body means we're going to experience those things ourselves. To have someone that we dearly love means we're going to experience their aging, their sickness. That we're going to, with friends, we can experience close friends. We can experience the same. People move away. They start families and often disappear from our lives. It's just the nature of what it means to have close relationships. The Buddha, with the monks, seeing how much sadness that this would entail. Of course, monks don't have romantic relationships. They don't have children, or if they did, they basically, when they enter the monastery, that becomes their life. Monks also are prepared for the for how impermanent and how little power or control we have in life. They don't even choose what they eat. Everything is donated. Their clothes, their rags they wear are donated. So, but we who are lay practitioners, we choose to be attached to things. And obviously a large part of what we do as lay practitioners is learning which things we can disattach from. Certainly, we can learn to disattach from careers and from endeavors and trying to find happiness through popularity, through worldly chases. But there's some attachments that we don't want to give up on or we don't want to disengage from that we want to keep very close to our hearts. And so long as we are aware of what that entails, which is a big part of tonight's talk, that's fine. The goal of tonight's talk will be to propose the ways that we make separation more painful and the ways that we can go about preparing for separation so that it won't be as painful as it is for so many people. That's not to say that there's ever a way to be separated, whether through death or through circumstances, from someone we love. But there are ways that, as the Buddha said, not only do we get shot with that first arrow, but then we shoot many more arrows into ourselves with unnecessary responses and reactions to loss. So, there's also this kind of letting go that I'm going to be talking about happens even earlier than we think with my father. There was the sudden decline of his cognitive faculties into making completely irrational decisions that happens often with old age. There's a letting go that happened with a friend of mine who was one of my closest friends and who had recovered from heroin addiction, but after an accident where he was, as part of his recovery from a bad accident, was given painkillers, and it just started him off into his addiction spiral, which he died from. And just being present for that. There's very little power that we have. We like to think that we can control other people, that we can step in and fix things, that we can grab hold of the reins. But actually, to love really means to discover how truly powerless we are and how much of loving is letting go. So the unskillful ways that we respond to when we see separation or old age, sickness and death, or people doing things without our permission that we believe are harmful to them. The first way is to simply just deny. I remember when my mom first got diagnosed with MS, I was very young, and she didn't really want to talk about the diagnosis. She didn't even really acknowledge that it happened, but she started to occasionally have these conversations where she'd go, well, you know, I'm going to die one day. And as a kid who was very young, I would greet that with, oh, I don't want to talk about this. You know, I don't want to acknowledge this. Let's not go there. Can we change this channel? You know, it's got to be something else on the TV of life than this conversation. So there's this, oh, I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear about, you know, what's going on. Can we focus somewhere else? Hopefully that doesn't last for too long. And then we move into the second part of the unskillful reaction, which is, I'm going to fix it. I'm going to take control and make sure that I'm going to step in there. So if my parents are now old and they're not taking their medication, or they're falling, or they're getting lost, or whatever, I'm going to just immediately redress this, find the, you know, assisted living facility, move them in. If my friend's falling into an addiction spiral, I'm going to take charge and find them a rehab. I'm going to do whatever it takes to make it go away. And, of course, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with trying to help, but very often this motivation to fix, to control, adjust, to take charge, is motivated by a desire to make it go away. And the problem is that generally when old age starts happening, it doesn't go away. It's not something that can be fixed. So if we're trying to just, like, come up with a solution. With, you know, both my parents, with my dad, it was a very steep decline very quickly. And there was no amount of fixing that could keep up with how quickly his cognitive and his physical skills evaporated in his middle 80s. So, and part of this is just really having the heart open to take in what's happening without always needing to have a judgment, a view on it, without always being in the strategizing, how can I make this better? Just really taking in, this is life. I was talking about yesterday when my dad was already in the wheelchair. My mom was in a vegetative state from the MS at the very end of both of their lives. My sister and I brought my dad for a last time to visit my mom in the nursing home, and he wanted just to kiss her, and to have that happen, we had to lift him up, both sides, getting under his arms, lifting him up so that he could momentarily just try to kiss my mom's forehead, and it really didn't work out. He sort of slumped back into the chair, and there's this very strong desire just to have this not be happening. Like, you know, who wants to see that? But there was a period of time where I was, you know, the whole diaper stuff with her parents is not something that anybody looks forward to. At least I didn't. And but it was very important for me to not only be there, but to be there with a very, very, a mind that was taking it in. And by which I mean an available mind is one that's not lost in thought. Like, this is horrible. This is wrong. You know, why can't we have more money to pay for somebody to deal with this? You know, just this whole thinking that pushes the experience away. Having an open heart means simply being present and allowing it in. A lot of the time, the feelings that arise, whether they're revulsion or they're sadness, they don't feel good. And nobody likes to feel vulnerable or feel, more importantly, feel powerless. But that's what separation, the inevitability of it, requires, is getting comfortable with being powerless. Another way we deal with it is there's the dramatizing, why me, this shouldn't be happening. A really wonderful example of that, well, it wasn't really wonderful, it was sort of sad, but I knew this person who's like a 95-year-old grandfather had a heart attack. And when the ambulance came, if everything worked perfectly, there was a small chance that they could have revived them, but they made one small mistake and he wasn't revived. And this person was outraged. How could this happen? How could this be? Got caught up in, like, I want to see a lawyer, I want to redress this, I want to... And it's not to be cold, but he was 95 years old. At what point do we acknowledge that there's a possibility that if you have a heart attack at 95 that you're not coming back? But rather than be with the feelings of loss and sadness and taking it in, another way the mind wants to react is to be outraged. This isn't fair. This is wrong. Why is this always happening to me? Sometimes the mind can simply turn off. Just go into, well, I'm never going to love again. Fuck that. I had a dog, it died, fuck that. I'm not getting another dog. Fuck dogs. They die, it's horrible. You know? I have quite a few cats, and that's part of the, you know, the experience is being with an animal that you love while they're putting it to sleep. It's the most... one of the most painful experiences, even with my friend dying, both my parents dying, all within an 18-month period, my cat also dying. It's just like, there was just as much tears. Just as much letting go. Just as much being present. So, finally, one of the most pernicious ways we deal with the possibility of separation is with worry. What will happen? You know, my child, he's going off to a college. He might take drugs. He will take drugs. You know, my parents are doing this. They're like, they're moving, and it's crazy. They're moving into the country, and they don't know anybody. Where my friend is doing this. It's crazy. She's going back with that boyfriend of hers. It's terrible. You know, and then this idea that if we worry, if we get anxious, that we can somehow, if there's a feeling of control when we worry. It's like this idea that either A, somehow the worrying's accomplishing something, that we're preparing ourselves. Oh yeah, I'm prepared, you know. I've envisioned how a really awful death for my girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, son, daughter, mother, father. I've envisioned their death, so I'm prepared. Doesn't work. Or we feel like somehow we'll have paid the penalty for the suffering, so it won't be as bad. That's not true either. All the worrying we do doesn't make it any easier when it happens. It's not a skillful... The Buddha didn't say, if you want to reduce stress and suffering, worry. And also what it does is it creates an addiction to the worrying mind. The more we do something, as neuroscience shows, neurons that fire together get wired together. They become ingrained in the habitual response areas of the brain, the striatum. So the more we worry, the more we worry. We're just giving more and more emphasis to that as the way we cope with the anxiety of separation we cope with worry. Then we just create a more worrying mind. That's all it accomplishes. It doesn't get anything done. So, given that these are the unskillful ways of responding, what are the ways that spiritual practice has to prepare us for separation with those that we love? The first is that the Dharma offers wonderful reflections, wonderful tools for reflections. The Buddha has his monks every day say the five recollections. They're very cheery. They go like this: I am of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to become sick. I am of the nature to die. All that I love, I will be separated from. All that I stand heir to, in other words, my happiness, is dependent upon my actions. So the fifth one is actually the optimistic one, or the one that says, well, we have some control over how happy or agitated the mind will be by the quality of our actions. But the first four is simply recognizing and reflecting on what it means to be born into this human shell, that we will experience old age, sickness, death, and separation from what we love. And Buddha actually had his monks say that chant three times a day, each time for, I think, 20 times. So you don't get that much of a distance from that if you're a monk. But in our society, in our culture, we really hide from this stuff. When somebody gets sick, they're whisked to the hospital. When somebody becomes old, they're whisked to the nursing home, the assisted living facilities. Let's go visit grandma out in somewhere in Long Island where there's a, seems like a factory where the old people are, you know, put. there's when people die, the bodies are immediately disposed of. So there's this cultural part of the way the world works to not acknowledge any of this, to not open the hearts to any of this, to push this away. Quite possibly because if we did see sickness, old age, death all the times, we wouldn't give our fucking jobs so much importance. That's actually one of the most amazing things that happens to the mind when we experience either, you know, you might get a misdiagnosis, or somebody, you know, might be spared something, or you become in contact with mortality, and suddenly all the little bullshit. My roommate leaves their towels on the ground. Outrageous. Hi, this is your dad. We thought your mom was dead, but it turns out she's not. Ah! You know, why did I care about that towel? Anyway, I'm making your shit up, okay? So I could have worked on that one a little more. All right. So there's a famous example of... I really didn't think I was going to get a laugh from this talk tonight. I'm relieved. So there's a famous teaching of Tisa Gotami, who was the woman whose son she believed was going to be the thing that made her life worthwhile, and her son died of a snake bite when her son was 4, and she was grief stricken. She went around trying to bring the son back to life by going to different wise people, and they couldn't deal with her, and they sent her to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, if you can bring me mustard seeds from a household that has not experienced death, I will help you. Now, of course, what he was doing is he was basically forcing this woman to go from door to door and ask for mustard seeds so long as there was nobody who had died in each family. And, of course, every family knew death. Well, in fact, my father-in-law, my sister, my uncle just died. So as she heard more and more stories, she became aware that it wasn't about her, and that self-dramatizing why me in relation to separation and loss was released. And because of that, she could turn the body of her child over to the Buddha, who stood with her as they cremated it. So this is a really important lesson, which involves when we experience the anxiety of separation, that a good way to work with it is to open to other people's experiences. There's a tendency when we hear about somebody suffering to really want to make that conversation go as quickly as we can. But so much of the actual strength that we can get is from hearing other people's experiences, because it relieves us of that sense that it's happening to us, that there's something unique or there's something wrong about it. And once we let go of the sense of this is wrong, we can really open the heart much more and we can let go. A second wonderful teaching that I love is Ajahn Chah's cup, which I talk about all the time, which is Ajahn Chah had the cup, and he wouldn't allow any of his students to have their own cups, but Ajahn Chah had his cup. And one of his students said, why do you get a cup? None of us gets a cup. We all have to use the cups interchangeably, but yours is a piece of tape saying Ajahn Chah. And Chah said, well, I get this cup because I know one day it's going to break. It's, in essence, it's already broken. This cup is impermanent, and I know that. So that when it happens, I will have the absolute right amount of sadness when it goes away. I'm not going to add any more suffering to it. So now when we hear this story, we can go, oh my God, my cup! My cup! My fucking cup is going to fucking break! Fuck this cup! You know? I want a metal cup! I don't want a fucking glass. I don't want a fucking ceramic cup. I want a metal cup. I want a cup like this. I want to drink from this one now, and I don't want it ever to break. So that's not the point. The point is actually. I like this cup, but it's fragile. I have to treat it with care. I don't really care about this cup, but I'm just saying that you know, if it's somebody I love, if it's something I love, I treat it with care. I really appreciate it. I open my heart to it, knowing that it's not always going to be around. That's what the teaching is. That's how to engage. You know, there's so often when we think that the people in our lives are going to be there forever, we can hold grudges. We can get angry with them over all sorts of shit. But if we really are aware that every interaction is going to be the last of its kind and we're not always going to have them there, then this tendency to like, ah, that fucking, you know, every time they do that, there's an ability to say, wait a second, I'm not always going to have this person. I'm not always going to have this. Do I need to carry around this regime of changing them? When in fact, there's change going on already. And it might be towards, you know, that outcome of separation. It's good to practice letting go in daily life. Luckily for you, you live in the metropolitan region. Every time I walk outside of where I live, like some business is closing, another one's opening, things are changing, people are moving away, you know, entire industries are going out of business. It's a fabric of change all around us, and there's a tendency to want to resist and not open to change as it goes on in our life. Everything that works smoothly, whether it's a friendship, it's a work environment, it's a band that we're in, it's a creative endeavor, it's a family arrangement, when things are going well, that is a very impermanent state. We get caught up in, oh, this is wrong, I'm going to work and people are not getting along right now. That's actually right. That's actually what happens in the world. Things happen beyond our control, without our permission, without our ability to have any power over them. So the sooner we can, rather than go in with that mind state of, I've got to fix this, and instead open to, wow, I've got no power here. People are deciding things in my job, in my life. People around me are arguing, and I'm just going to open to that inability to control them. It's so much easier to fall into the either A, I don't want to look at this, I don't want to know about it, you know, they're acting crazy, just keep it away from me, or B, I'm going to fix them, I'm going to go in, I'm going to tell them what's right, I'm going to be the referee, I'm going to make sure they know what's going on, Neither of those is preparing us for anything other than being busybodies. Most of the time, the way we fix things is only very, very impermanent anyway. They last for a little while. And then the fighting, the flaring up, the falling apart, the changes continue without our permission. It's really, really opening to letting go, basically. Letting go of that feeling that there's something we can do about life. What we have control over is basically the way we use our minds and how much additional suffering we add to life. But in terms of other people, situations, the amount of control we have is very limited. When people are acting particularly bad, we can get our distance. We can remove ourselves to get some security. When people are needing our help, we can be compassionate. But in general, even in those situations, we can't really change the way they behave. No matter how much we like to think that we can play a role in guiding people back to sanity or health or to behaving in ways we want, we really can't. One of the most moving experiences was when my friend was becoming, again, a junkie right before my eyes, before he died, just being there, seeing that, and acknowledging that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't stop it. I was going to be present in his life, even knowing that the outcome that happened was a very likely one. That's opening. That's letting go. That's being present. And even though I know we all want to believe that when the time comes and the people around us are sick or becoming old or becoming infirm, that there'll be something we can do about it, most often the only thing we can do is simply be present for them. As I teach at the hospice training center, that's the bulk of what we do when we do hospice work. There's this myth that we can show up and have conversations, and but most of the time it's just being present, taking it in, having them know that there's somebody there who's allowing it to happen, who's present with them. So that's really all I got. I hope somewhere in there was a little bit of something worth thinking about. I thank you for listening, and...